Hermann, welcome to the Commerce Talks podcast. I really waited for this one because I always wondered, how is the fashion industry working in the Scandinavian countries? You're running Boozt, a website which is showing up in all like leadership rankings when it comes to e-commerce business models in Europe. And now I can finally learn how this works. Please introduce yourself to the listeners who might not know you yet.
Yeah, thank you. It's a pleasure to be on your podcast. Yeah, my name is Hermann. I'm originally from Iceland. Moved to Denmark when I was 14 and have been living there ever since. The company is located in Malmö, Sweden. And I think the brief history is that the company was originally founded by some other people that was basically wanted to do e-commerce for fashion brand. So a kind of a monobrand business, very much influenced by the UX business model back then. And I was approached by a VC firm that had invested. But in their view, the management or founding team was not the right team to bring it forward. And they didn't think that kind of the business was sustainable. And they had just signed an agreement with Bestseller, the Danish fashion company, which is rather big, big shareholders actually in Zalando and ASOS as well, and About You. So they had signed to build and operate all of Bestseller's e-commerce in Europe. So it was a huge monobrand contract. I joined in February and found out that the business was nothing more than a PowerPoint presentation. We tried to launch the Bestseller business, you know, Jack and Jones, but it was basically crap. Everything was outsourced. 5 employees. The front end was outsourced to
when was it? 2010?
2010. Okay. Beginning of 10. The front end of the web shop was outsourced to Vietnam, and the back end was outsourced to India, and it was a disaster. I found out, and they didn't have any tech competencies at all. Everything was outsourced. I tried to to say, okay, how can we build it up and build their own tech? But before we kind of managed to do that, Bestseller resigned the contract. They were kind of 99% of the business, and they said that they wanted to end the contract in June 2011. So we actually faced kind of, should we close down the business or something else? And I managed somehow, and I don't really know now how I did that, to convince the VC firm to do a restart. We thought a lot about, should we close down the company and start all over again, or continue in the Boozt fashion or BZT fashion business, as we wanted to finalize the business with Bestseller and keep good relations with them. We kept the business or the company and got rid of the founders, and I called some of my old friends, people that I've been working with in the past, and asked them if they wanted to do start basically a fashion e-commerce business with me. And we were like 5 guys in our 40s, did not know anything about fashion e-commerce. So we said, okay, well, how can we do that in a smart way? So we just said, okay, let's just copy what we thought was the best department store in the Nordics. So that was kind of the start. And we launched Boozt with, I believe, 9 brands back in 2011, 9 brands and no money. And then kind of tried to hustle our way forward based on that. So it's almost embarrassing to think about that we were not kind of 9 brands and building on that. And again, as I said, we didn't know anything about.
What was back at the time? I think Zalando started in 2008, 2009, About You 2012, 13. Was Zalando kind of the poster child in the e-commerce fashion industry even back then? Or was it ASOS?
Yeah, Boohoo? You know, Zalando had actually just launched in the Nordics when we launched. But our big, or the ones that we kind of aspired to were, was mainly, Zappos in the US, who were kind of really, really good back then.
Remember.
And we thought that their kind of their approach to the customer and the customer experience was great. A lot of people said that we should try to copy ASOS, who are kind of the leading e-commerce fashion shop in Europe, but we said, but we don't know anything about fashion. You know, we don't have have the kind of the influencer approach. We don't know anything about kind of how to attract these young fashionistas to the site. So we said we would rather like to target someone like our wives, who were kind of more kind of in the 40s, you know. So we said, okay, let's go for the customer group that might be kind of 30 to 50 years old, who are maybe not fashion forward, more fashion followers, who appreciate kind of a good customer experience, because we knew that we could build a strong customer experience, and then we would get the kind of the fashion element as we grew. So that was kind of, we started almost the opposite way compared to a lot of other people that were interested in fashion in the beginning. We said, okay, let's build a great platform. Let's build a strong supply chain. Let's use our marketing, media and marketing competencies to build a brand, and then let's get some fashion people on board. So it was very much kind of going for the older customer who are more fashion followers.
And was it already Nordics focused or Sweden only when you started it, when you restarted it?
It was actually, I know it sounds strange, but actually the main focus in the beginning was Denmark. And the reason why was that the entire founding team, or the kind of the refounders, as we call them, were five guys. We were all Danes. So you might say it's a strange thing that you have a Swedish company with the founders being Danes. And three out of five, we used to be in the media agency business. I was the Nordic CEO of the biggest media agency group in the Nordics, you know, Omnicom Media Group. And I used to be the biggest customer of a lot of the media houses in the Nordics, especially in Denmark. So we used our connections to make great media deals first in Denmark, and then in Sweden, Finland, and Norway. So it was kind of, our expansion was very much driven by our ability to negotiate good media deals.
But media deals, just remind us there. So I remember, Zalando was also known for this kind of big media deal with ProSiebenSat.1, which was recognized as the first performance-based TV deal. It was unheard of before. So they paid ProSieben based on revenue expansion that was driven by TV ads. Nobody did it before. Was it a similar deal structure which started Boozt back then, or was it different deals?
It was very similar. We have been, back in the late 90s, we started with doing econometric modeling in my old agency. So we know a lot about how media works. So we can actually use that knowledge to kind of to demonstrate to it was TV stations, because we were very big believers in TV. So kind of to how can we demonstrate the contribution on TV to our sales, and we made kind of deals that where we could kind of pay by performance, and because we didn't have any money, so we couldn't put up money on front, and we managed to kind of convince the TV stations to do deals like that in the beginning.
Ah, nice. And if you're scrolling fast forward to today, can you give us a rough understanding about the KPIs, revenue, employees, global reach, maybe in the business itself?
We are in the label ourselves as being a Nordic department store. Last year, our revenue was around 700 million euros, and our adjusted EBIT was 5.2%. I believe actually we are the most profitable e-commerce, fashion e-commerce company or pure player in Europe.
70 million euros?
700 million euros.
700.
7 million is our revenue. And our EBIT last year was around 40 million euros. Oh no, 35 million euros, something like that.
Nice. Okay, that's for sure a number others would like to see.
Yeah, it was 5.2% adjusted EBIT, so it was good profitability. From the beginning, we are mainly focused on the Nordics. 90% of our business is in the Nordics. And the reason why is that kind of, even though back, when we started, there was a lot of talk about, the beautiful thing about e-commerce is that you can go global mainly, basically from the beginning. You have the long tail, stuff like that. So we kind of have been building brands our entire lives. So we believe that, you want to build critical mass in your home markets before you even think about doing any expansions. And we know that The Nordic customer is more affluent than the average European customer. They like brands, and of course, Zalando had just launched, you know, with the biggest assortment ever seen in the Nordics of any fashion company. But we thought that kind of in this mid to premium segment, there was a spot where we could go in and take a kind of a share. So from the beginning, we said, okay, let's do this Nordic expansion, focusing mainly on Nordics. And then basically taking it country by country. So Denmark was the first country, then Sweden, and then Finland, because we managed to do a good media deal in Finland. And the last country to go into was Norway, you know, for the Nordic countries. So, and that is kind of our biggest expansion. Then, of course, lately we have been also going to the Baltics, because we regard kind of the Baltics being kind of Nordics or Nordic minded. So it makes good sense, you know. So. Of course, we sell a little bit in Germany and the Netherlands, but it's kind of, we said that everything we sell outside the Nordics, you have to be profitable, you know, for every single order. So we're not investing if we don't get immediate return. So we are kind of a very focused company, focused on our segment, focusing on Nordic brands. I believe 60% of our revenue is actually Nordic brands. And these are typically small, mid-sized brands, where we have, of course, quite a strong relationship, and typically the biggest customer of these brands.
And the business model itself, is it still that you are buying the merchandise from the brands, have it on your own risk, on your balance sheet, like owning the inventory risk? You run the warehouses, you run the logistics, you own return risk, and you're making your margin, the 5.2% margin, based on this risk position. So it's just like a standard markup game you're in. Is it correct?
We everything we sell on the site, we have bought, and it's in a warehouse. We have one central warehouse located in southern Sweden. I believe it's probably the biggest automated warehouse in at least in Northern Europe. We have almost 1,300 robots running on top of a grid from a company called AutoStore that has 1.3 million bins in, and we have around 11 million items in these cubes. So it's highly automated, meaning that we, you know, it's around 90,000 square meters, and we have around 600 warehouse staff. In total, the company has around, I think, 1,300 employees. We kind of put a lot of pride in being few people. You know, we have a policy of being one too few, based on the saying that, you know, if you want the work done, give it to a busy man. You know, and again, we never had the money to invest in a lot of resources. So we all kind of, you have never heard us going out and say, you know, we want to employ 100 people or 200 people, because we think for us, a street credit is to be as few as possible. So our kind of philosophy is to be few people, get the best people and pay the highest salary in the industry. If you can do that, then you have a very good company.
Okay, I understand that. And the I'm just asking this question, if you're owning the inventory risk, because you said that you have listened to some Kassenzone podcast and then Commerce Talks podcast. What we are seeing over the last like 2, 3, 4 years is that most horizontal retailers that are still owning the inventory risk want to move into the platform game, because within the platform game, you can change your business model away from product margin towards media margin, because you're then selling access to customers, and the risk, inventory risk, return risk, is handed over to the brands. And I'm pretty sure if you're like following the market now for over 10 years, 14 years, if I'm calculating correctly, you might have been confronted with this task, building a platform yourself. And now you're looking from the very nice country, from Copenhagen or from Malmo, and the area where I'm living, it's called the Danish Forest. So it was Denmark until 1800 something. So it's kind of you're sitting in front row. You can watch what ASOS About You, Zalando, and whatever everybody's doing, and you still have not moved into this world.
Yeah.
Why is this?
And I'm actually pretty sure that we will never move into that world. I think it's the wrong model. And I think that the economic results or financials demonstrate that it's not a very good model. And the main reason is that you don't own your own shop, you know. So because if you don't own the inventory, of course, it looks very nice on paper. You can get consultants who can convince you by showing some PowerPoints that it's good for your networking capital. You don't have any risk. You don't kind of tie in capital, and you basically it's all upside. But history shows that it's more downside than upside, because you know you don't own the inventory, don't control what the consumer gets, and in many cases you don't even have the goods in your warehouse. Meaning that you give a bad customer experience by doing drop shipping, et cetera. So we have been moving in the opposite direction. You know, up until lately, you know, we had consignment agreements where some of our brands owned the items in the warehouse, but we have now moved everything to owned by. Meaning that we control what is displayed on the site, how it is displayed, what the price is, et cetera. And we believe that it's the right model. And in our view is that, you know, the partner program model, where the brands have the goods in their own warehouse, it's a kind of a lose model, because you know nobody makes money on the model there. It's a lose for the brand owner, because they're having paying fees to the platform. It's a lose for the platform because they risk sending kind of items from different places with a free basket size. It's a lose for the customer because they have a bad customer experience, risking kind of receiving two or three or four shipments from the same order. So I think in my lifetime, you will probably never see us moving into that direction.
No, I am. I think it's still an open discussion. I agree on this on the perspective that it's way harder to control, obviously, the customer journey, and that based on very very limited logistics capabilities of the brand and also the increasing complexity on the tech side, it's very hard to pull it off. But if you're looking at the new Chinese platforms rushing into the European markets, in your industry, it's definitely Shein, which is like a verticalized platform, I would say. They're like turning around the supply chain. Or if you look at like Temu, which is more a media model than a retailing platform, then it looks very, very interesting. And the moment you're competing with a business which is running in the platform world, which doesn't care about product margins anymore, then your proposition becomes weak. So what you're saying is seems, and it's an open discussion. I don't want to lecture here, so I want to learn from you. But it seems that it's a luxury position to be in, that you can still afford to hold the inventory risk to ensure a higher customer satisfaction score, I would say. But when brands that are now sold at Boozt are also available at platforms that are in a platform business model, therefore usually go below your prices, because to ensure the quality you're providing, you need to earn some money. And we are not talking 20, 30, 40% EBITDA margins. We are talking 5%. So nobody's like taking buckets with gold out of your business. But the moment when there's like a cheaper provider, customers tend to forget about quality and trust and relationship and move to the other provider. So, and that's why I'm asking, it's okay today, but the market seems to be heading in that direction, because it forced to move in that direction. And the only business that gave a similar statement like yours was Thomann, which is like the number one audio provider for audio technology, microphones, music instruments, from 1 billion revenue roughly, which is like 25% of the European market. And he said, back at the time, I will never allow dirty marketplace products on my well-sorted shops. It will destroy the customer experience. Mm. And he was right, but he was the market leader, so nobody was able to compete with him or the platform. And here I'm asking you the same. So the moment somebody steps into your market, into Denmark and Sweden, offering similar brands for a way lower price, then you cannot hold the proposition.
Yeah, but that, you know, that then you're assuming that someone steps in and can offer the same or similar brands at a lower price. And of course, they can only do that if they have a lower cost structure than we have. Mm-hmm. And our claim, of course, is that we have by far the lowest cost structure of all the players because we have a very simple setup. Again, only one warehouse, highly automated, well invested in technology. Everything that basically is in our ecosystem is own built. And if you know, and I think you should be really, really careful comparing to what happens in China. And you look, if you look at Temu or Shein, the reason why they are successful is that that it's dirt cheap what they're selling with very, very low quality. And this is also why I would say that you know, we believe that we have found, or some of our investors are saying that they believe that we have found kind of a sweet spot to be this mid to premium priced positioned player in the Nordics. So because, you know, we're not luxury, where the brands own the customer and the customer journeys, where we can see that the platforms or the multi-brand shops are having difficulties in basically getting access to the inventory and don't make money. And we're not in the enterprise that are competing against Shein or Temu. So when, you know, and again, when we started and during our first years, you know, we'll be told that, okay, if someone like Amazon or Zalando or maybe About You want to destroy you, you know, they can do that at will. And we, because they can either go cheaper or outspend you in marketing. But in our view, they can do neither part because, you know, our basket size is almost twice the size of our German colleagues. So, and we are spending 10% on marketing. So if they, so in absolute euros, they would have to spend something like 20% of their kind of sales on marketing, which would not allow, and they can't afford to sell at the same or a lower price than us because our cost structure is just it's optimized and much lower. So we believe that we are strong. But of course, you know, I might change my mind. You know, in 3 years' time, it might be different. So again, being from Iceland, you know, I have my views, and I think it's much more fun to have a provocative statement than just being
cool. We all want to learn here, but then maybe can you give us some like historic or your version of like the market entry success or failure of like Zalando or About You or ASOS? Because from my understanding, they all tried the Nordics already, because like for them, it's like a market close by. They can serve them from existing warehouses. Big enough if it's understood as an aggregated market, if you like put all the markets together, or just Denmark and Sweden, I think that is like 80%. But they have tried it, right? And you said it yourself that when you started Boozt, Zalando just started market expansion into Denmark. So what is their status quo? Because if you are running a 700 million euro business, there's not too much space.
Yes and no. Actually, I have high respect for Zalando. I think they're actually outstanding. And I think that they are doing a lot of good stuff. And I believe that they are very strong in the Nordics. So Nordics is probably one of the best markets. And I can't point at them doing anything wrong in the Nordics, on the contrary. So I don't think it's because they are doing something wrong. I think that we are positioned slightly different. We are more kind of mid to premium and more local brands. And of course, we have the advantage of being here in kind of in Malmo, 600 people only focus on the Nordics. Just makes life, if we can be more focused than they can, because they have to take care of all the markets. So I think that kind of, I hold them in high regards. I think the market is big enough for both of us. I believe that when the dust settles in the Nordics, there will be two, maybe three big players who are much bigger than the rest. And I believe that my hope is it will be Boozt and Zalando. And I think that will be the case because it seems that we are kind of the strongest players and the best position. So, and you know, the e-commerce penetration in the Nordics in our categories, it's somewhere between, it's around 25%. And we believe that in 10 years, this number will be closer to 50%. And I think that the combined market share of Boozt and Zalando in the Nordics is probably below 20% of the online. So you will both see consolidation, meaning that, you know, that people will consolidate their buys with the big platforms like us, and then you will see increased penetration. So there's a lot of room to grow. So I don't see that we, you know, Zalando and Boozt are competing kind of head to head. It's more like that kind of we're taking the market share that we're getting from the rest. So I hold them in high respect. So I can't point at them doing anything wrong. It's more that kind of we are more focused on the Nordics.
What do you think is their revenue in the Nordics? I don't think they
they don't disclose it, but they are at least twice the size of us, I think. So they are bigger than us, much bigger than us in Nordics.
Okay, and do you think this is because they have like a vaster category setup, so different brands? Because obviously, if you're looking like from a very, very high perspective on it, you're both selling fashion, more or less.
Yeah, but we are, you know, fashion for us is kind of, the share of fashion of Boozt is getting close to 50%. So we also sell beauty, sports, kids, and home. So we are moving much more into being the department store. This is also why our basket size is much higher than the rest. I think the reason of I'm sure that the reason why Zalando is much bigger than us is that, you know, we launched with like 9 brands back in August 2011, and they launched with like the biggest assortment, more than 2,000 brands that you had ever seen in the Nordics. So they basically took the market. And I know some of the people that were with Zalando in the Nordics in the beginning, and they always talk about that it felt like it was just like walking into into a candy store and just picking down for themselves, because there was no resistance whatsoever, because the incumbents, they basically was sleeping, you know. So this is why they're bigger than us.
And the other online players, ASOS and About You, are they relevant for in your perspective?
Yes, but they are probably kind of more into the more enterprise level, and so we of course compete when we, it could be on Google, etc. So buying keywords, but we don't see them as a more kind of more direct competitors.
Okay, Google is a good keyword actually. So because one of the things that are letting me rethink my own understanding of e-commerce with Shein and Temu is obviously they have a way of like trapping the customer in the app. So they eventually save money on Meta and Google and charge money from vendors that want to show themselves in the product feed in the app. You're still then sticking to the standard e-commerce customer journey. So people starting their search for whatever, sometimes on Google, sometimes on Amazon, sometimes on other sites, sometimes on your sites. And within the search process, you're trying to show up as a trusted retailer for the product or brand the customer is searching. And then you need to restart the whole game because your customers are only showing up, I don't know, 4 times, 5 times a year, or buying stuff 4 or 5 times a year. And in the other platforms, they're showing up every day. And therefore, the whole systematic of like how the customer journey is managed is a bit different. Can you share a bit more about your customer journey approach? So is what I've described, is this correct? Or is it like more you're sending out still mailings, which is a high activation channel, or are other search engines popping up in the Nordics, which we might not have heard about yet?
Now we are, you know, I think kind of as a base, we are kind of media agnostic. So we actually really don't care where the consumer journey starts. We send a lot of mails out every day. So it still works. We still use mass media, use TV, outdoor radio, magazines, etc., etc. And then, of course, buy a lot from Google, etc. We launched just after summer last year a Boost Club, which is our own customer club, which is gaining momentum. So we are kind of using all channels, and even we have also built quite a considerable revenue in our retail media department. We have something called the Boost Media Partnership, where we offer brands to do campaigns using first-party data that we have on customers both on-site and off-site. So we're kind of using all channels, and it's actually kind of a core competence, because we are, the founders, we grew up in the media agents business, marketing business. So this is something that we are, in all modesty, are really good at. So we basically use all channels and have the app and basically use all means available. And we have the big advantage that our basket size is so high that we get great return investment. We can actually pay a good amount on customer acquisition and still make money.
What is the basket size? You're saying it's double the size like Zalando?
Our net basket size after returns is around, I believe, 85-90 euros.
Okay, that's nice. And shareholder-wise, it's still a private company, if I am...
No, we're listed. We are listed in both Stockholm and in Copenhagen. So we were listed on the Swedish Stock Exchange in May 2017. And then I believe it was actually 2021, November, we listed, did a dual listing in Copenhagen. And that was to a big extent due to the, Denmark is our biggest market. The biggest shareholder base is actually based in Denmark. And we, in many ways, we feel as much being a Danish company as a Swedish company. This is also why if you ask people in Stockholm, they a lot of them actually think that or believe that we are a Danish company.
Ah, okay. I don't know so many people in Stockholm, some, but most of them with like a German origin. So they said it's a Swedish company. But yeah, I understand that. And Malmö is pretty close. It's like across a bridge from Copenhagen for the ones that don't know where Malmö is.
I can literally kind of see Copenhagen from the window of my office. So,
but can you take a ferry from Copenhagen to Malmö, or do you need to go through the tunnel?
There's a tunnel and a bridge. Yeah.
Okay. So, understanding that, but moving a bit forward. So, with a competition environment that's getting a bit tense. So, for all sides, it's getting tense for the old players like Zalando, because they need to, they are forced by the financial market to earn money to show like similar margins like you're showing, means that I cannot invest in new markets anymore. They will pull back on every investment that will cost them money for the next 5 to 10 years, focusing on like payback time. On the other hand, you have now the Chinese platforms moving into the market that are not yet loaded with like big brands, but if you're looking at what Shein is doing, they've bought some brands like Forever 21, which is kind of the entry price level, not yet the direct competitor, but still it's kind of they're making smart moves. So you're not moving into the platform economy game. Got it. But what then your view on the future? Still sticking then to the being the best platform for fashion in the Nordics, or is there something else?
I think it's important for us to say that we want to be more than fashion. So we want to be a department store. We really, really like the department store model, which means that customers are in the market more than just fashion, and more often than just doing the fashion buy in the spring or in the fall or in the winter, etc. We like simplicity, and I think that for us, kind of one of our big advantages is that we don't really have any issues, right? We don't have to fix stuff. our inventory position is strong. We don't have any old inventory. We only have one warehouse. You know, I thank God that I don't have the complications of having multiple warehouses where I have to consolidate, either do drop shipments to the customer or do internal consolidation. You know, we only have one place, which is the same place as the warehouse, where we get the returns. We only have like around 600 white collar employees. Most of them are located in Malmö. So it kind of, in that many ways, you know, we can focus. My life is simple. I always have this ambition of being able to kind of make things run on autopilot so I can play some more golf. I don't manage to do that as well as I want, but kind of, so I think that a big, you know, basically our advantage is that it's a very simple operation. It's a department store. No one else is really, we don't have any other of the big platforms or players that are doing the department store play. And then we believe that the market growth is still high, you know, and our guess is that the online market in its own will grow somewhere between 5 and 15% every year for the next 5 to 10 years. So I think that the most difficult thing in being in our business is to stay focused and keep your discipline, because it's so tempting to get, I wouldn't say bored, but you want to kind of do a lot of stuff and you have so many distractions. And if you listen too much to consultants, they will try to convince you into all kinds of stuff. Oh, so that's why we know basically.
I have a consultant question for you then.
We don't have any consultants in the company and never have had. So
okay,
but that might be my famous last words.
So many consultants might have to convince you into the AI game, like creating an app experience which is like super tailor-made, or creating, instead of like one boring white picture of a t-shirt, like 10 videos out of this t-shirt with like different models wearing it, and therefore increasing conversion rate, blah 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 blah. You would know it, what in this presentations you will find. So what's your view here? Have you done something like this?
Yeah, but you don't need a consultant to tell you how to use AI, because that's kind of...
Right, but that's how they earned money last year, with presentation telling you about AI.
And again, you know, it's large language models, and they have big advantages, but they also have big limitations, you know. And you know, we have been using machine learning a lot, and I think you should distinguish between the language models and machine learning, and we've used machine learning a lot also, because again, we couldn't afford to hire people, so we tried to kind of use technology to do our work. So in the beginning we've used machine learning, and are now using AI to basically reduce friction internally. Basically, how can we make our coworkers' life easier by using AI? And then, of course, and the next thing will be kind of how can you make it easier for the consumer? And I think that in our business, AI is God sent, you know, and it will favor the big players, because it will enable you to reduce costs a lot, because they will do a lot of the boring stuff, you know. It could be translations, it could be product descriptions, it could be images, etc., etc., etc. So I think that, again, we are, you know, the big players, and in all modesty, we regard ourselves as being one of the big players. You know, we can spend a lot of resources on developing that, and so of course we are using AI a lot to get costs out of the system. You know, reduce friction both internally and towards the customer. So we see this as a big opportunity.
You've said that like translation is a thing for you. So for the countries you serve in the Nordics, like if the core countries are Sweden, Denmark, Finland, and Norway, are you providing product descriptions in each country language?
Then? Yes. Product descriptions, etc. And you have like four different languages, four different currencies. So these are small kind of. Population, so that's why, you know, you have a lot of costs, you know, we are showing images, you know, on our site on mannequins, and a lot of people have asked us, you know, why don't you show them on live models? And the truth is that we couldn't afford it when we started, and then we thought it was good, and then we kind of add on, and stuff like this will help us in kind of improving the customer experience. And then finally, of course, you know, we all want to be able to provide the customer the kind of a very kind of, in real life shopping experience, meaning that you go to the shop and say, I'm going to a party on Saturday, you know, I have this in my wardrobe, what should I wear? And it's just a matter of time before you can offer that online. And this is kind of, I think, that where you will get a big leap forward versus the, also the physical store, that not only you can compete on the assortment and pricing, but also now on the customer service and advice. So I think that is a lot of opportunities in AI there.
Okay. So I wasn't aware that like you still have like four different currency. In Finland, you have the euro, and all the rest still has their
Swedish krona, Danish krona, Nordic, Norse
krona. Okay, the krona. It's similar. The names are similar.
And the Swedes don't understand the Danes, and vice versa, and nobody understands Finnish and the Norwegian. So that's why I kind of it's rather expensive to kind of have this local approach in the Nordics, and you have to be close to the markets, and this is what we can do with AI.
Okay, and then my last question, because we're like heading to an end here, regarding the state of brick and mortar and the potential growth scenario for you. So you might have seen like in Europe a lot of like department stores, like even like brick and mortar key places like Lafayette in Berlin is about to close, for example, do have like big troubles. And you might have seen the press reports on KDV. All about like brick and mortar shopping. If you're living in Copenhagen, then all the tourists are moving in the small like streets shopping thing. So from like an outsider's perspective, it feels very, very lively still. But is there like an overarching brick and mortar issue also in Sweden or Denmark, which is driving then your growth, or is it very different from Germany or UK?
No, I think it's exactly the same as in Germany and UK. You know, you have this very romantic small shops, you know, in the kind of in the old towns of the different, you know, capitals and cities, But you know, if you look at a multi-brand retail and fashion, they are closing down. You know, and you have a lot of small, medium-sized towns and municipalities in the Nordics that all used to have kind of 3, 4, 5 multi-brand fashion stores, and they're all closing down. So, and you can, you know, in many ways it's a pity, because you know the city center is changing, but the physical retail store, it's difficult because they can't compete on assortment, they can't compete on the price, and even on the service level, because they can't afford to hire good people, right? So I see a very limited future for brick and mortar. And if you ask me about, you know, how do I see, you know, in 10 or 15 years' time, I believe that in 10, 15 years' time, it will be the online players who own also the physical stores, but they will be more kind of a marketing tool or showroom, because, you know, I think it's going to be really, really difficult to make money in a physical store, because it's just like they are not competitive versus the big platforms.
Okay, that's a clear remark. Then telling my wife that she should enjoy the shops in Aarhus as long as she can, until you have to run some pop-up stores with Boozt over there. Anything else we are missing, like from our very German perspective? And you're reading like German news as you said, your story reminds me a lot of what we've talked with Lena Hackeler, our co-host in the Swedish market here a couple of years ago, when we talked about like Amazon is about to come to Sweden. Everybody was like super, super, super afraid that Amazon now is there in Sweden. It will destroy the whole ecosystem. I think they finally arrived, so you can order there from my peers I know in Finland and Sweden. They still order from amazon.de because the shop is bigger, and so the amazon.se or fe, yeah, I don't know if there's a Finnish version, yeah, it's not really highly regarded. So has it changed anything for you?
No, not really. You know when we listed the company, a lot of investors were holding back because they said, hey, you will be killed when Amazon enters. And we were just basically waiting, can't they? When will it come so that we can kind of get that elephant out of the room. And they launched, I think, 3 years ago. And Amazon is an amazing company, but you know, fashion or department store is not their main game. So, and they're still, you know, it's a marketplace shipping from different locations, you know, for different countries. So the kind of end user experience is not very good. Like, so you want to know exactly what you're looking for if you will shop with Amazon. So again, if we focus on the mid to premium segment with Nordic brands for Nordic consumers, I think we still have a good business.
Nice. I think that's very good closing remarks. I would love to see you at some German conferences because you might add a very, very refreshing perspective. Because like there's like too many like doomsday talkers like me saying like the old world of e-commerce is over and we need people like you or my friend from Thomann who's like defending the well-managed inventory in the own warehouse against the Sheins and others. But it gave me a lot of like very positive perspective looking forward. I hope our listeners and readers are understanding the Boozt value proposition a bit better. And I hope we can do a follow-up anytime soon. And now I know you're living in Copenhagen, so I know where to go to record an on-site podcast.
You are so welcome. Thank you.
Thank you.